Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you, whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita.
I'm Ron.
And Jean Marie will not be with us today. It's migraine time. Collectively, we are the hosts of Podcast DX. On today's show, we're speaking with Dr. Daniel Murawski. Dr. Dan is a functional medicine doctor who works in collaboration with his patients to find and treat the root causes of disease and reestablish wellness. Doesn't that sound like everybody should do that? His interests include, GI diseases.
I think you might have found another doctor.
Yeah. Immune dysregulation and hormone dysfunction. Dr. Dan is joining us today to talk about hormonal imbalance. Welcome to the show, Dr. Dan.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Actually, let's just jump right into it. What got you started in a medical career? How did you find medicine?
Well, I wasn't always sure I wanted to be a doctor, but my mom was a nurse practitioner and kind of steered me in that direction. She was an ICU and a SICU nurse for, well over 30 years almost. And my dad is a computer engineer. So when I was looking at undergrad, I decided to do engineering and more specifically biological engineering. So specialty in the kind of cell and tissue. And it kind of worked out really well because spelling and writing weren't always my strengths, but mathematics, I could do very well. And the reason why I loved engineering was that ability to view things as systems and figure out how the systems interact together in order to kind of optimize them. So fast forward, I was in this debate between what do I do after undergrad? Do I go into a master's of engineering, kind of pursue that, or do I do do medical school? And I had my MCATs going, and I took a year off, got really into like yoga, self-healing. I think at one point I was doing I fell into the hot yoga scene, but also the hatha yoga scene, and had some really good mentors. And from there, I started diving into more of the looking at the body more holistically in my own life. So when I found out what a doctor of osteopathic medicine was, that was kind of my calling because they really focused on the fact that there could be a muscle skeletal component of visceral disease, right? So asthmatics can have, chest and rib dysfunction that could be corrected to help with wellness as well as using your standard medical interventions. As I went through, I figured, what would the other justification, and I like to joke about this, is when they asked me in med school why I want to be a doctor, I told them, because it's a trade. If the world were to, kind of end in an apocalypse or something like that, well, we need the carpenters, we need the farmers, we need the medicine men. So it felt like a really core trade as well, which felt kind of like you're contributing to society more and like community. So that kind of led me there. And functional medicine, I think when I started training with at the time it was the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine, I fell into that functional medicine kind of module. And functional medicine essentially views the body like an engineer. It says, okay, we are all human beings with the same set of physiological systems, but how those systems interact with one another is very unique to the individual, and the variables that are go into those interactions have yet to all be discovered, but what we do know, we can try to change. And that's kind of where that holistic approach comes from.
Nice.
So that's kind of it kind of justifies everything then. It allows you to have a wider scope, a larger lens, so you're not just stuck in like one paradigm at a time. And I think that kind of opens up more acceptance to different healing modalities.
So. Excellent, thank you. And Dr. Dan, could you give us a quick walk through the endocrine system?
Yeah, sure. I was thinking about this, the podcast, and I was like, hey, you know what? Like, how does everyone who I like lecture, they always begin with like, well, what does endocrine even mean, right? So stems from the meaning within, and then crine is secreting internally or internally. So when you think about endocrine, we think of it secreting within, right? So the endocrine system itself is a very large group of organs that are responsible for basically communication throughout the body. I like to think of it in terms of global or satellite communication. So everything from regulation of our metabolism, our homeostasis, our growth and development, sexual function, reproductive function, mood. Those are all influenced by the hormonal system. And specifically, the endocrine system is made up of many different organs of the body or within the body. Everything from our thyroid, our adrenal glands, which secrete cortisol, and from some of our sex organs, our testicles, our ovaries, and so forth. So ultimately, the endocrine system is the balance of communication and homeostasis within our body.
Okay. And what function do hormones play in the body? I mean, that's a huge question, and I know what the answer is, but if you could summarize.
Okay. Well, that is a gigantic question.
Right,
Um, so I
sorry
guess it
about
really
that.
depends. Yeah, no worries. I kind of like to look at it, and I take this from the IF or the functional medicine kind of platforms and the look there. I like to think as hormones and as almost a pyramid structure, right? So at the bottom of our pyramid, we have our stress hormones, our cortisol. Cortisol could be responsible and is responsible for maintaining our blood sugars, our blood pressure, our certain aspects of our metabolism. When we think about then, okay, that's kind of the foundational principles that can influence everything else. We all know that stress hormones influence in both positive and negative ways. Thyroid is kind of another classic. I'm sure you guys have spoke about thyroid at some point here, but that's more functional within our metabolism, how our body regulates energy, our heat, how cool we can make ourselves. So from that end, we then think, okay, well, cortisol can affect the endocrine system and the endocrine, excuse me, cortisol can affect the thyroid, and then thyroid can ultimately then let's talk sex hormones. So sex hormones we know of as testosterone, progesterone, estrogen, prolactin. There's more than a few out there, but those are kind of your main players. And those guys affect everything from our reproduction, our maturing, our growth, going through puberty, to our fertility, ability to maintain muscle mass, our mood, and even more recently, our cognition, our ability to keep our memories, and our ability to keep our overall longevity and vitality.
Okay, thank you.
So, I don't know if this is going to be just as wide of an answer or much more narrow, but how would you best explain a hormonal imbalance?
Oh, yes. So there are many different hormonal imbalances out there. I guess like the most broad definition would be thinking, well, if I have a, there's a delicate interplay of all of the hormones within our body, every one of them, right? Everyone else, right? So we like to think about it as like negative feedback loops or positive. Occasionally, if something is, there's too much of something, you may have an overly suppressed negative feedback loop where the communication becomes out of balance. I feel like some of the best ways to think about the hormone imbalance would maybe be some examples. Like a classic example of a hormone imbalance would be the thyroid. Someone with a hypothyroid or a slow a thyroid that takes more work to secrete the same amount of thyroid hormone or a very slowed down secretion of thyroid hormone would have an imbalance of too little hormone. This could manifest as different symptomatology such as fatigue, weight gain, feeling cold all the time, brain fog through the day. Other hormonal imbalances may occur, such as a classic thing that some people will see is perimenopause or menopause. Early in the perimenopausal timeframe, we often think about what happens to the different hormones and how do they become imbalanced. Well, one of the things that most functional medicine docs who work with hormones, they tend to focus on the imbalance of progesterone and estrogen during those times. So as a normal female ages and becomes or gets closer, I should say, to menopause, you might see a lower progesterone during part of the menstrual cycle. And that imbalance can create an imbalance in how frequently menstrual bleeding occurs, how heavy menstrual bleeding occurs. It could affect sleep patterns. So hormone imbalance is basically defined as an imbalance between any one of those many hormones and its effects on our physiology.
Okay. I don't know if this is...
Well, I was going to ask a follow-up, and then you could... So he's going to ask his question, but I'm just curious. Isn't that lack of, or that less of progesterone or estrogen or whatever we're lacking as we get older, isn't that a normal part of life? And how can that be considered an imbalance if it happens to everyone as they get older? Isn't that just part of life?
So I guess that would be getting into a little bit more of the philosophical piece of it. I was really inspired. I once heard a lecture where they discussed the average age of a human being in the 1920s, and it was somewhere around the age of 46. So that means like 50% of people never really experienced the loss of hormones or made it to that point, right? So what changed from the 1920s to today? Our technology, our ability to keep women alive during the birthing process, our ability to get a supply of food, sterilization, you know, whether or not that's bad or good can be argued, but cleanliness, hygiene, and then the ability to save people from accidents. I mean, ER medicine is probably some of the better medicine in our country, right? And so by having people stay alive longer with the advances of technology, we start wrestling with the idea of what is appropriate aging and how much should we consider aging as being or what can we consider pathologic and what should we consider normal becomes a huge debate, right? I think that would actually, that becomes a very personal decision for people, I think. And if we can apply, say, a hormone, or like, say, a lot of people nowadays are really kind of that hormone replacement therapy is kind of hitting the scene a little bit more. And I know that the current presidential administration, they just authorized, I think it was well over hundreds of millions of dollars to women's health studies during perimenopause and menopause. So trying to understand how to appropriately help somebody during these transitions or what they want becomes very important. So I like to think of it like this. This is kind of bad because I always talk to my patients and my clients, and I'm a man who does not go through menopause, but I have a car metaphor for hormones, okay? And so I always joke, well, I'm describing women's hormones as a car metaphor, right? It's kind of ridiculous. But I usually kind of take the body, most men, male or female, is 50 being that 100,000 mile marker on your car, right? So when we hit that 100,000 mile marker, we have to decide how well we want to take care of our body. And when we make this decision, we want to also decide, well, how much do we want to do in life? Do we want to still try to go out and do the sports we did when we were in our early 40s? Do we want to, what is our goals? What makes us happy? So if you're going to use hormone replacement therapy to balance a hormone or replace something that naturally goes away, we have to then say, well, you better keep the body safe. You better oil the engine. You better look at the parts. You better make sure you're using this appropriately. And furthermore, when you think about it, if we know through maybe some of the studies now that something like a hormone replacement therapy, when initiated at an appropriate time, may prevent osteoporosis, diabetes, reduced risk of colon cancer, a general trend towards the reduction of clogging of the heart or plaque in the heart vessels, then we have to decide, do we want to age into those diseases and do our best to prevent them through lifestyle modification, diet, and all that, and those components? Or could we take that extra step with some of the risk that may be there and prevent the diseases from occurring as quickly and maybe slow down the aging process? And for me, if we're lucky that we get 80 years on this planet and we can make our, you know, 60s and 70s with as much vitality and as much be there for the grandkids, be there for your kids, then, you know, it's just the weight, and it's just the weighing out the negative, the positive, and deciding what that person wants. And ultimately, it's providing autonomy from my position, autonomy being how much information can I provide my client, my patient, in order to give them what they want, make them understand any of the risks. And I know that was a long-winded answer for your question about hormone imbalance and natural aging, but I think that it has to be taken into context of both a philosophical and a physiological phenomenon. So.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. So I'm going to follow up that with what can cause a hormonal imbalance and what symptoms might a hormonal imbalance cause in men or women?
Sure. Oh, that's the fun stuff. So
we ask a hard-hitting questions.
You do. And if you feel like there's any, I love focusing in on examples because that makes it really easy. When I talk in broad range, I get a little, I kind of go all over the place sometimes. So if you want to redirect me, feel free. But I really love this stuff. So the first part of the question, what can cause a hormonal imbalance? Mm-hmm. I think one of the broadly what can cause hormonal imbalance would be inflammation, autoimmune disease, cardiometabolic disease. We call it meta-inflammation. Environmental pollution, that's a huge, I think, contributor of hormonal imbalance, along with diet, not only in regards to poor kind of this, what we call the sad American diet or the standard American diet, the sad diet, quote unquote, but also the pollutants that I had mentioned within our foods. Chronic stress can cause hormonal imbalances. I think that's a really fascinating area of research that I'd love to elaborate on. Those are kind of, I would lump those. So kind of thinking environmental, diet, stress, and then inflammation related to either autoimmune or other disease processes, I think all contribute to a hormonal imbalance.
And some of those we have control over and some we do not.
That is correct. I think that some of the research in PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, if you guys are familiar with that process, PCOS, you know, broadly defined as irregular menstrual cycles, androgenic symptomatology in females, so acne, hair growth, kind of like my mustache called terminal hair growth, weight gain, and then infertility. These are kind of the big ones. Now, interestingly enough, the uncontrollable things they're seeing nowadays is that there appear to be some genetic links to how the hypothalamus, which is kind of one of our main control centers for hormones in our brain, there is actually genetic components that may cause the hypothalamus to pulsatilely secrete something called gonadotropin releasing hormone too quickly, and that imbalance of how it pulsatile frequency can cause a shift in how the pituitary gland signals the ovaries. So there's a really couple of cool lectures out there on it, and they kind of go into, well, why would that have evolved in our society, right? Why would we have people like that out there? And they kind of equate it to this phenomenon that might occur due to a different way the hypothalamus and pituitary gland signal sex hormone creation in a female actually creates an androgen dominance, a testosterone, so more of a male energy, if you will. And they actually kind of say, well, this could be a big spectrum, right? So we have our athletes, like female Olympians, we take our track stars, you know, kind of like all the women out there are very much on top of their game. And we say, is that a component of that maybe genetic trait where they're harnessing some of that ability to create more musculature, to be more athletic? And some people take that all the way down into like evolutionary standpoints of, say, if you were in a tribal culture, you lost your partner with your kids and you had that genetic trait where you could go hunt better than, say, another woman next to you as a different genetic component, well, then you're more likely to survive and keep your offspring going. Where you take that same genetic variant in today's society and it might otherwise become pathologic because the environment around it becomes harder to control, right? So that's the uncontrollable component. The controllable components, I think, are like, you know, how can we avoid, and we'll get into more of this, I think, how can we avoid stress? Although that gets a little harder with being so connected to the internet constantly and in the 24-hour news cycle. How can we clean our food up? And How can we filter our water and avoid drinking from plastics? Those are all things that are somewhat in our control. From an environmental standpoint, obviously, we can't completely control all of it, but we do have some things we can take control of, which I think are very important to always remember and consider when making your day-to-day life choices. So I think the second part of your question was, how do some of these symptoms manifest, right?
Right.
As I mentioned already in PCOS, which is a very common one, that's an easy one to kind of drive from. So for females, when we see hormone imbalance, say considering only the hormones that are responsible for, like the sex hormones, can see irregular menstrual cycles, infertility. As I mentioned earlier, we can see androgenic changes. We can also see things like low estrogens or high estrogens. We can see joint pain. We can see heat and cold intolerance, especially if the thyroid gets involved. We can see weight gain, especially around the belly. We can see poor sleep patterns, lower mood, depression, anxiety. So very broad array of symptomatology when the hormones become imbalanced. For men, I kind of focus in, I like to joke, men are a little easier. The intricacy of hormone play in a man is kind of like an on-off switch with one volume, kind of, right? It's just testosterone up, testosterone down, testosterone off, testosterone on. But for a man, you know, you might see like hesitancy or indecisiveness. We see lack of energy, decreased work performance, low sex drive, or inability to reach an orgasm. We see a decline in strength and endurance during workouts, enjoyment in life, muscle wasting. Those are all kind of things that are in those subtle changes when, okay, say, testosterone starts leaving the body there. So.
Thank you. Would you say that hormonal imbalances affect men and women equally?
I do. I think there's more of an emphasis, I mentioned, on hormone imbalance in males a little. I feel like just, you know, there's a certain point of medicine that was driven for a long time by kind of a male culture, right? So we have all the testosterone that we can find on the market there. And I feel like women's health was relegated to birth control pills for a while, right? And there's still a lot of passionate doctors, don't get me wrong, and a lot of people are out there, and everyone means well. You don't get into medicine without the intent to help. But sometimes the tool sets aren't always there. So I think that hormone imbalance in this day and age, whether it be from an environmental factor, is affecting everybody equally. But I do think that within females, it can be more pronounced because there's two major changes in a female's life between puberty and menopause, which can show and manifest those symptoms more than I think a male sometimes manifests with. So,
okay. All right.
What about, are they age specific, or is it just a matter of when you get older, this is going to happen?
Well, that is age specific.
When it's age specific, I'm talking like 40, 50.
I love it.
Or just the general aging process.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I'll allow it.
Yeah, for sure.
You just did a rap song, okay?
Yeah, I know. Okay. I'll never look that down.
It was good. I liked it. I feel like there is a lot of age-specific stuff, but again, that kind of dives back to that long walk on the short tangent I took earlier about the philosophical idea hormone imbalance means when we age. There are a lot of people, I see the gamut. More often than not, I do see a decline in hormones with age. There are some lucky individuals, they're doing something right, and I think there's a play in the genetics that keep the hormones. Mm-hmm. But from an age-specific standpoint, I think it's undeniable that as we age, we lose that, the biological clock slows down, and we lose that ability to create hormones like we need to. I do, however, think that when it comes to age specificity with other things, whether it be PCOS, like I had mentioned earlier, endometriosis, or some of these other like hard-hitting things that the teenagers, or even dysfunctional uterine bleeding, or irregular menstrual cycles, all of this stuff is like, can be any age. And we see a lot of it at the onset now of puberty. So there's definitely there's very specific types of changes based on age.
All right. And What methods do you use to test for imbalance in the hormones of a certain person? Is there a standard that people should be at, and then all you do is compare the standard to what they tested at, or?
Any good doctor should always correlate symptomatology with laboratory findings, no matter who you are. Saying somebody can be defined in a reference range is not always appropriate, I don't think. There's, when it comes to like standard, I think then too, that's also something that needs to be more elicited. There's like a standard for thyroid. However, there are some debates on like what that reference ranges mean, right? So when I test someone for an hormonal imbalance, the first thing I want to know is what are the symptoms I'm looking at in a person, mm-hmm. and what is their underlying issues? Because in the end, it's about providing quality of life and vitality for somebody by doing the least amount of harm while doing it, right? So I don't want to just patch someone up knowing that how the treatment I'm giving is going to cause some major destruction. I want to find how can I patch somebody up so they're going to keep getting better with age, right? So first off, we always have to define symptomatology. When I do an initial hormone, when I'm testing for hormone imbalance, I like to do a combination of any of three kind of tests, if you will. I like to look at serum hormones, since those are kind of a standard of practice within the medical community. And then I get a little bit more advanced when I'm looking at an adrenal gland or cortisol, where we'll do a salivary test, where we look at the salivary excretion of cortisol over the course of the day at different time points. And this allows you to get a general idea of what the adrenal glands are doing. A lot of hormones are rhythmic in fashion. Cortisol itself will peak in the morning and then kind of wave out towards the end of the day and kind of nadir when we're going to bed. There are some people who are up high all day. And when I identify those kind of people, I'm like, these people are really feeling a lot of stress. They have their sympathetic or fight or flight response is going, and they are secreting a lot of cortisol. So when I'm assessing those patterns, that's very helpful to know. Now, on the other side of that, we can often see people with a low cortisol secretion throughout the entire day. And that's where that idea of adrenal fatigue has been thrown around. And if you, as a physician, were to tell an endocrinologist, this person has adrenal fatigue, they will yell at you, or they will say, this guy does not know what he's talking about. So, the wording is kind of off. Your adrenal glands, if your adrenal glands are not working, you will know it. You need your adrenal glands. You need cortisol to stay alive. Otherwise, your blood pressure will drop. You'll be in the hospital. You will not be alive without your adrenal glands working. The question is, and this is kind of where I think that whole idea of adrenal fatigue and how they're elucidating a little bit more about the underlying mechanism of it, is actually towards chronic stress. So there's this term called allostasis. Allostasis is this idea of like how our body deals with an outside stressor. And the allostatic load over time is that's the load of stress over time. So there are some studies done where they look at what chronic stress does in, say, like animal models. And we all know that when we're chronically stressed out, not sleeping, you get less than 4 hours. I mean, what happens to our creativity? It drops, right? We can't think, we can't remember. Yeah. So they're trying to figure out, well, what does this all mean, right? So when we're chronically stressed and we're bathed in cortisol just day in and day out, there's actually a phenomenon called dendritic pruning that we found in some of these mouse studies. And what that means is that the actual organelles within the brain, the neurons actually become smaller. They start pruning, like pruning a tree. And we, over time, go into a catabolic state within the brain where we're eating away neurons. So this adrenal fatigue may not actually be a result of, you know, my body can't produce cortisol anymore, but the central nervous system telling the rest of the body, hey, you're just destroying me. I need you to slow down. My brain is not functioning, and in doing so, you drop your cortisol level. And those could be people that are always wired and fatigued, right? You're always just kind of like there, you're fatigued, but you're kind of wired, you're off all the time, you want salt, you want dopamine, so you're going for that sugar. And in doing so, now you're eating inflammatory foods, but what does cortisol do on a positive note? Cortisol decreases inflammation. It allows our it fluxes up blood sugar to resupply glycogen stores in muscles, right? It helps us live. So when we lose that ability to control our inflammation, suddenly now we're inflamed all the time because we can't produce cortisol. We're tired all the time, but we're always sick. So that's that stress response. Mm-hmm. To pull people out of that is sometimes very hard. That's where the lifestyle, the diet, sabbatical. I mean, I feel like we should all be able to take sabbaticals.
I'm curious. I mean, your occupation then could potentially be, you know, part of that. If you're in a high stress job, you think of the air traffic controllers. You know, I mean, they've got, you know, or police officers, firefighters are constantly stressed. So something like that could be a contributing factor then.
Oh, of course. I see that so many clients. I have police officers, I have like firemen, doctors. I like to say if we all could be like treated like college professors and we had this ability to take like a sabbatical for a semester, right? We would all be, I think, a lot healthier people. It would be great because a lot of times you can take someone with like, say, even a GI dysfunction, right? Like an IBS, and you can get them 80% of the way healthy. But every time they get hit with a stressful event, which are unavoidable, it just, their gut goes bad again. So it's kind of like always trying to pick up the pieces. And that's the power of this, of our hormones, is that they, our response to our environment and the amount of stress hormone, that's like kind of, I think, one of the major keys in our society that keeps us from like really achieving the health for a lot of people. Because situationally and culturally, society, we don't have that ability to relieve our chronic stress a lot of the time. And there's a lot of people in bad positions that just don't have that mechanism or those safety nets to really just take time off and allow them, their body to heal. So.
Well, if that's the case, what treatments are available to take care of hormonal imbalances for the people that are stuck in the environmental stress?
The environmental? Well, I'm a big fan of, get out of the stress. That's, you know, I'm always trying to do that. But if that doesn't work, I'm a big fan of starting like with basic, simple stuff. One of my really good friends, he's a men's health coach. Introduced me a few years ago to this book called The Mantram Handbook, right? I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the author's name. Plus, I would probably butcher the name. I think I opened it up with, I'm not good at phonics. It's one of my weaknesses. But like something simple, a mantram, which you guys are probably familiar with at this point. There's mantrams in every single religious practice, whether it's like a Catholic with a Hail Mary or like the most common, which the yoga culture, or I guess it would be, you got it, Om. And then I think Gandhi was Rama, Rama, Rama. That was his thing, which is just like this deeper connection to a spiritual divine. The beautiful part about these practices is that they can be done privately in your own brain at any moment of the day. And the more you do it, the more you create a path, the more you structure yourself. There's a great, one of the great metaphors or great stories that he tells is about like elephants in parades in India, where he talks about a good elephant handler. You can tell the quality of the elephant handler based on the elephant's behavior through the parade route. And a very crazy elephant that's grabbing food off a food cart, grabbing something out of someone else's hand, that's just like, it's distracted. It's just moving back and forth. Where a good elephant handler will give a piece of sugar cane or a something for it to chew on during the entire time. So the elephant stands up with pride, it's occupied, and it just goes and does its thing. So I like to think of that as like a chewing gum effect, right? Like the mind is occupied because we don't know why our minds just race and go off into the negative thing, positive thing. No one really knows why that happens yet, like how the flow of our mind, that unending thought process and consciousness. But the mantram, when you practice it, whether it's just like I am joy, I am peace, Rama, 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 anything, it allows us to take that monkey mind, that elephant mind that's just going back and forth, and center it back. And that's a simple practice to try to decrease the sympathetic drive and try to just pull back that racing thought. So then heart, you can expand off that if you're really disciplined to like heart math, meditation, really looking at different types of very like transcendental stuff as well. So there's a lot of variation with working within one's mind. If there's trauma, trauma. I'm a big fan of therapy. I think everyone should be in some therapy after what happened in early 2020. I think we're all a little bit traumatized still, and we all probably could use some good therapy to work that stuff out. So addressing any trauma and any cognitive patterns that could lead to that sympathetic mm-hmm. drive. So taking a walk, putting your feet in the grass, those are kind of our overlying standpoints. When we want to get into now the funner stuff, it kind of where I can tell people to do this, but I don't have the ability to sit in my office and guide someone through a meditation, although that would be a really cool way to begin a visit, the stuff that we do to help people from my standpoint, an herbal-based medication is there's a blend of adaptogenic herbs that we use, like ashwagandha, something used in Ayurvedic medicine for over 2,000 years, which can calm the cortisol response down in the mind. Rhodiola, the ginsengs, those are all things that we try to use to calm down a overly stressed cortisol production, which can help balance it. When it comes to diet, anyone who's stressed should definitely be getting enough foods with B complexes, good leafy greens, magnesium content, the proteins that are responsible for making these hormones, the cholesterol, all this stuff is very important to support those adrenal glands and support our body during times of stress as well. So these are all just milder interventions. If the other stuff starts occurring, like thyroid disease or so forth, then we start focusing more on the nutritional components of how to make a thyroid go more appropriately. And say that ultimately you're losing testosterone or you're going through a perimenopausal time, you're stressed and there's a lot of stuff, then that's where we can discuss hormone replacement therapies as well. So yeah, it's kind of a tiered approach to this stuff. And that's my main approach.
Thank you very much. And how long does it take to rebalance a hormonal imbalance, I guess, in a typical patient?
Oh gosh, it all depends on what's going on, right? You can have a guy with low testosterone, and if they want to do it from, we'll say, a holistic or like a integrated approach, then that could take, 6 months to a year, depending on how long they've been stressed, how it's low, why it's happening, how long it takes to build some muscle. If they're wanting to do some, say, testosterone, and they just be like, you know what, doc, I'm in a spot where I just can't make these changes, you can start seeing differences in how someone feels within 2 to 4 weeks. So I like to joke, or not even joke, the female body is very powerful, right? Or female hormonal imbalance. Everything occurs monthly, right? So we usually have a 28-day cycle or 30-day menstrual cycle. So when you're trying to correct something within a female hormone imbalance, I always say, well, if we're going after something that's involved with, say, sex hormones, we got to wait at least 3 cycles because no herbs that I give you, no lifestyle changes are powerful okay. enough to affect that female pattern, if you will. So
that leads us into the next question. I guess hormonal levels are checked regularly to assess whether or not medications need to be adjusted.
So if you pay attention to say North American Menopause Society, Endocrinology Society, ACOG, when it comes to female hormones, and say you are giving a medication for it, there's not really a recommendation on how and when to recheck, which is kind of interesting. I think there should be some more standardization. I personally check to see where the hormones are, depending on what delivery methods I use for hormones. For males who are undergoing, I'm just in the world of sex hormones now, testosterone replacement therapy, any adjustments should be followed up with a check of testosterone and some other hormones within 2 to 4 weeks of making those adjustments. Within thyroid, this is kind of a cool point, I think, that I would love to share with you and your audience. Like thyroid itself, I think everyone should have baseline thyroid testing at least once a year, full thyroid panels too, like looking at the different components of thyroid TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone, free T3, free T4. And the reason why is more and more, we're finding that the genetic set points for people's thyroid is different mm-hmm. from person to person, right? And if I'm trying to replace thyroid hormone for someone or balance their thyroid, and I had this data when they felt great, this is what it looked like, and this was their generalized trend, I could be shooting for things back when they actually felt good, and that might be their actual set point
right.
rather than some lab designated variability. So I am a believer in checking. Checking is better than not checking. And then, like, say it comes to treating something like the progesterone deficiency in the second half of the cycle, well, then it's very specific to, okay, let's try to map your cycle. We can even do cycle mapping and find out where the hormones are going during what parts of the phases of the cycle so we can take intervention and try to figure out how best to help the person. So,
excellent.
I know that was a lot of little things in that one. So,
well,
but no, it's going to be helpful for people who are listening.
Right.
So in your opinion, what role does exercise play in hormone regulation and balance? I mean, we all understand the importance of exercise, but in this particular case, in these particular cases.
Oh my gosh. I love exercising. So, you know, this might be biased if I have to put out any of my conflicts of interest. My conflicts of interest is exercising. But I think there's an orthopedic physician who does a lot with hormones, like called peptide therapies. And he jokes that, you know what, what's the largest endocrine organ in the body? Muscles, is what he always says, because they produce something called myokines. And myokines are like signaling molecules that regulate our hormones and help to like balance our hormones. So when it comes to exercising, exercising will decrease excess estrogens for people. It will improve lean muscle mass, which in turn will alter how our hormones are secreted from different areas. We can boost up testosterone by improving lean muscle. The very active exercising and just decreasing body fat, right? If we're able to burn some fat, that'll decrease the amount of an enzyme known as aromatase. And aromatase is this molecule or enzyme that will convert testosterone to estrogen. So if that's over-expressed, say you have your classic Midwest, I like to call it Portillo's eating, you know, guy you would see on WGN News when they're doing a thing about obesity, like, and just shooting those different clips, right? The pot belly over the belt kind of thing. There's a lot of conversion of testosterone to estrogen when you have a lot of visceral fat. So just the act of exercise and be able to maintain an appropriate amount of fat in the body will help balance the estrogen and the testosterone for every human being. So I think it's very important. You got to use it or lose it kind of thing in the end there. So,
and I would guess that nutrition plays hand in hand with that, because the proper nutrition, you're going to have a better chance at a proper exercise routine and get everything balanced, right?
Actually, nutrition does not matter at all. I'm just kidding. That's bad.
No. Oh, okay. You got me on that one.
Yes. Nice.
I'm sorry. I
2 points for the doctor.
Like there's so many variations on nutrition there and like why it's important. I could tell you, like, from a micronutrient standpoint, believe it or not, in order for like an estrogen molecule to appropriately bind with one of its receptors, it requires adequate amounts of zinc, vitamin B6, magnesium, iodine, and vitamin A. So, like, that's just incredible to think about, that we need nutrition just for receptors of hormones to work appropriately, right? I can't tell you, it's widely accepted that low iodine intake can predispose people to autoimmune thyroid disease, like Hashimoto's. And if you think about it, what is one of the biggest fads right now, or was the biggest fad? It's the use of sea salts, like non-iodized salts. But in the Midwest, we were a goiter belt back in before they had iodized salt. They considered the Midwest one of the largest producers of goiters because there's no iodine in our minerals and our soil that like can get into our body. When we get into these health kicks and we don't understand exactly what amount of iodine we should be getting, I feel like I've seen a lot of people with low iodine levels. And then the controversy around how to replace it is a whole other world. But, you know, some people will use really large amounts and not. But iodine deficiency. Another one that I love to think about is like our high-end athletes or people who work out a lot. Well, if you're not supplying your body with enough amino acids and protein, which I feel lacks in the standard diet, then your body's going to decide what's more important, healing your gut that's such an overturn, or keeping that lean muscle going, And maybe you'll see some athletes with chronic GI IBS-like symptomatology. I like to always talk when I'm counseling patients about the NHANES trials, the National Health Assessment Nutritional Exam Survey. It's a very long trial where they interview many Americans and they try to assess for like adequate intake and what the American population is really getting. And over again, you'll see this in like different lecture sources when they're quoting NHANES, is that the average American, up to 95% or so, and I might be off by a couple percentile points if you're going to fact check me, is magnesium, chromium, and zinc are just 95% of the population doesn't get their RDA values of it. And you think about, well, what does magnesium do? It's a cofactor in more than 300 chemical processes of the human body. So you think deficiency, what does magnesium treat? We use magnesium to treat sleep issues. We use it for constipation. We can give it IV to kids with asthma who to break an asthma attack in an ER. So all of these things that you're like, well, if we just had adequate magnesium, would this stuff be an issue? Or zinc. There's a whole controversy on zinc, or not even controversy, but the idea of if I take a bunch of zinc, I am going to get over a cold faster, right? I like to pose the question, zinc in high amounts might be antiviral if it gets into the cells, but if we all had adequate zinc, would we all get sick as much? And with the studies that say zinc is good and zinc is not good, is that the variable between them? Is like, how do you actually assess the load of zinc in a human being, right? And then chromium, I mean, chromium is blood sugar, blood sugar, blood sugar. So how many, when it comes to like that part of that endocrine system, right, the insulin and all of that component, if we don't have enough chromium in our body, our insulin receptors are not going to be as sensitive and we're not going to be able to feel the insulin when it comes through to work. So we're going to start building more insulin because we got to shout louder at ourselves to work better. And that can be just one little part of the whole process. And to dive back, like I just go off on these things, tangents from each thing, is that another fascinating thing is like arsenic and persistent organic pollutants, which are common in like rices, like white rice or so. Like that's a fear when you like get the sources of white rice from unknown areas. Well, arsenic can suppress pancreatic secretion of insulin, and then persistent organic pollutants can make it so our insulin receptors are less sensitive. So now is it really the carbohydrate in the rice and the energy molecule in the rice, or is a part of it some of these toxins that are disrupting our endocrine system? So it's really just fascinating when you look at someone and you're just like, there's so many things that could be, so many variables that affect the system, the endocrine system. I'd like to share one more variable on that affects the endocrine system that I think I'm pretty passionate about, if that's okay. Uh-huh. Like bisphenols, right? Everyone knows that BPA, or it's commonly accepted that BPA increased risk for breast cancer, right? So if you look at some of the old literature back in the, BPA was studied back in the early 1900s as a medication to help with menstrual symptomatology in females. So whether it be premenstrual hysteria, quote unquote PMS or whatnot, the non-political correct way of talking about it that they used to say. The only reason why BPA fell off the market of being a drug during that time, because it got replaced by a better synthetic estrogen called DES. And if you're familiar with DES, it's like diethylestradiol. It was a synthetic estrogen commonly given between 1930 and 1950 to women who may have been at risk for miscarriages. And every baby who was exposed to DES in the womb, not every, but the majority will develop some kind of genital cancer, whether it's an ovarian or whatnot, breast, they're at high risk. So BPA got booted off the pharmaceutical market for manufacturing because of a better drug that is a known risk for cancer. And we screen, are you a DES baby? Were you exposed to it in the womb when we're screening for cancer? So it's just kind of like, there's so many things out there that we just don't know. And so many things that's why I don't drink out of plastic ever. I don't drink out of soda bottles. I don't drink soda. So, you know, it's kind of, but that's like, you know, avoiding those risks and cut me off whenever with a question.
No, we try to.
As a consumer.
Right.
It blows my mind just trying to go to the doggone grocery store now. You know, or everybody drinks bottled water.
We got away from glass. Nobody sells. Well, there are a few products that are still sold in glass, but for the most part,
you're doing
all
what
of
you're
our
supposed
drinks
to be doing, and you find out that no, that's the wrong thing to do. It again.
We kind of hope that the FDA is going to keep us safe.
Yeah, we hope.
Who does the shopping in your household?
Yeah.
Who does the grocery shopping in your household?
My partner, my wife does more.
Okay.
I can't lie. If I had let more time, I would. But we are in a general agreement. We follow the shop around the outside. We try to feed our kids mostly plant whole food. So meats, veggies. We very rarely do processed things in packaging. And then I just avoid a microwavable dinner. I would never feed my kid. Maybe once every month. All right. Because again, I can't escape the regular society, but I try to make 80% of our life as healthy as possible, knowing that I still want to live and go out to dinner. And, I try to make 80% of our life a good pattern. And I rely on my wife for doing most of the shopping because she takes up that part of the responsibility in our household, which I truly appreciate. So.
Okay. Well, now that we have a little bit of background information on hormonal imbalance, it's time to talk about our initiative. To better serve our listening audience, we are an affiliate of a major medical supplier here in the United States, and you'll find affiliate links on our website, podcastdx.com. They aim to tailor specific medical supplies and equipment based on your diagnoses to make it less stressful than looking through an entire catalog for what you might need. We're open to your suggestions and will adjust our offerings based on what you, our listeners and guests, find helpful. But now let's return to our show. Dr. Dan, could you tell us a little bit more about your role at Case Integrative Health?
Oh, sure. I am a primary care family medicine board certified physician with my additional training in functional and integrative medicine. I tend to take on a group of patients, whether it be hormonal imbalances and GI disruption, as well as immune dysregulation. So I'm kind of good family medicine, a jack of all trade, master of none. I know what I don't know, but I take care of a lot of people within that realm. At Case Integrative, we do treat a lot of complex medical conditions, the more of the fibromyalgia, the chronic fatigue, the chronic infection world, which I know can be controversial for some listeners, but the chronic Lyme disease or toxin exposure. And basically, everybody has systems that need to be optimized. So my role at Case is to be part of that team and help optimize each of those systems within more of those complex medical cases. So that's what we do. And I really appreciate being there. And the best part about Case is we really do get to spend the time with everybody, which I think is required to do this kind of medicine.
Okay, thank you very much.
So what advice would you have for current or prospective medical students?
Are you sure?
That's not as that was good, but not as good as the nutrition one.
The last 4 years, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's so it has to be a passion. It has to be a passion, and there has to be considerations around the burden of stress and financial stress that you're going to take. And I always say every medical student should proceed with caution and be sure, because we live in a world where I feel, and this is from my heart, is some days, there was points in my career where I felt resentment against my profession because of the amount of debt that I'm in to be a doctor. And I did not have any generational wealth or anything to help pay for med school, and I'm still paying my loans. And a lot of this debt relief doesn't apply to doctors because we make too much money. But that's not quite true when you look at some medical students like myself coming out of a osteopathic school with over $400,000 of debt with greater than 6% interest, right? So I always caution now, if this is a passion, do it, because it is so great to be part of somebody's life, to have that component there. But to weigh the stresses of the financial stresses, the amount of time that it takes to commit to people, because you do commit your community, and you have to commit yourself to not only your family is there, but you have this commitment to your patients as well that starts to rival those parts. And finding that work-life balance is one of the major things I think needs to be stressed to anyone who's considering being a medical professional, whether it's a nurse, a physician, or anything at this point in time. So my advice is be sure you're passionate. If you need to take some extra time to figure that out, life's too short not to do the right thing that you for yourself. And consider the overarching changes that need to occur to provide work-life balance for everybody at this point. So,
and what do you personally do to reduce stress in your life?
I'm a guy who likes that external stress, right? I like the exercise. So my big hobbies, I surf in Lake Michigan. I am an avid Lake Michigan surfer. So, and it's best during the winter time. So that's my biggest passion. I will drop everything on a day where there's surf. I will wake up at 4:35 in the morning to be there so I can surf before going to work. I also like to, do like some, road biking. I've been doing yoga for many, many years now. So I've been, all around the yoga scene. So a lot of that stuff is how I de-stress. And then being with my kids on a weekend is a huge component, and family and friends. A night out with some good friends, watching the kids play with their friends in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That provides so much relief for the next few days until we hit the Sunday scaries and get into the work week. So
all right, great. Thank you. Well, Dr. Dan, thank you so much for joining our show today. How can listeners learn more about you and Case Integrative Health?
Oh, sure. Case Integrative Health has a website, very easy to Google and find. And then the social media handles are at Case Integrative Health, whether it's Instagram, it's a good place to start finding out a little bit more about us if interested.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll put links on our website for that. And if you have questions or comments related to today's show, you can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com. On our website, podcastdx.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram, and TikTok under PodcastDX.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast. And as always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment, and before undertaking a new healthcare regime, and never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something that you have heard on this podcast.
Till next week.